mich sperren. Im Grabe leg ich euch des Heilands Huld. So schwach doch bin ich ihm zu dienen. Du bist im Dienste deine Schuld.
Keiner diese Qual ermisst, die mir der Anblick weckt, der euch entzückt. Das ist die Wunde ihrer Schmerzenwut gegen die Not, die Höllenpein zu diesem Amt. Sieh voll ganzes göttlich Erdehalt erglüht mit leuchtender Gewalt. Und zückt von seligem Genusse des heiligsten Blutes Quell, will ich gießen in mein Herz. Des eigenen sündigen Blutes Quell, in wahnsinniger Flucht muss mir zurück dann fließen, in die Welt der Sündenzucht mit wilder Scheu sich ergießen. Von Neuem sprengt es das Tor, heraus es und springt hervor. Hier läuft die Wunde, der seinen gleich geschlagen, selben Stier.
vor. Dort hinaus einen Wege zu, doch rät dir Durnemanz, lass du hier künftig die Schwäne in Ruh und suche dir Genfer die Gans.
We've just witnessed the ritual of the Holy Grail at the end of the first act of Wagner's opera, Parsifal. The elderly Grail Knight, Gurnemanz, is sung this evening by Sir John Tomlinson, the Wild Woman Kunji by Katharina de Leyman, the Lord of the Grail Knights, Amfortas by Detlef Roth, standing in for an indisposed Ian Paterson. His father, Titurel, by Reinhard Hagen, actually unseen. His disembodied voice is emerging somewhere next to the Royal Albert Hall console, the organ console. And as soloists are lined up at the front of the stage, bowing to the promenaders here, Robert Murray and Andrew Green as the two knights we heard after the prelude, and the squires sung by Sarah Castle, Madeline Shaw, Joshua Ellicott, and Andrew Rees. Sir Mark Elder conducted the Halle with the men of the Royal Opera Chorus on stage and off stage. Mark Elder gesturing to them right now. Up in the gods here in the Royal Albert Hall, you heard the young voices of the Trinity Boys Choir and the Halle Youth Choir, pretty much hidden from view here in the body of the hall. Takes hands with the Halle's leader, Lynn Fletcher. And Mark Elder was telling me yesterday how he always looks forward to those boys' voices emerging at the end of the first act. It's such a magical sound for anyone who hasn't heard Parsifal before, he told me. And he was actually reminiscing about conducting the offstage elements of Parsifal as Reginald Goodall's assistant at English National Opera, just as Jamie Phillips is for him this evening. And what about those bells welcoming us into the Grail Hall? Absolutely immense. Well, the soloists leave the platform. Mark Elder once again gesturing his thanks to the offstage voices. And right at the end of that first act, after the ritual unveiling of the Holy Grail and communion, Gurnemanz is left alone with the strange young man who killed the swan, and the old knight is irritated by the ingenue's inability to understand what he's witnessed. But a voice from on high, mezzo Madeline Shaw, reminded Gurnemanz of the prophecy of redemption through an innocent fool enlightened by compassion. Well, even by the end of the act, we don't know the young man's name. Of course, it's Parsifal, sung here by Lars Klevermann, who's also sung the role of Siegfried in Wagner's Ring Cycle, as well as Parsifal.
I would like to compare him with Siegfried, even if there are differences. He has a lot of potential. but he hasn't made any kind of experiences. So he has to find his way in the world and understand himself and humanity. So he's really like a starting point, you know, a zero that has to be filled with something, learning and developing. That's the path for Parsifal and also for Siegfried. And since they are not knowing who they are and how the world is, there is a certain frustration in their souls. So they become violent and frustrated to get to know, to try to understand what's happening around them and inside them. But Parsifal is perhaps more like really a child, naive. There's a vulnerability there that Siegfried perhaps lacks most of the time.
Swedish tenor Lars Klevermann, Parsifal, in this BBC Proms production of Wagner's last opera. And we'll be hearing more from Lars later about Parsifal's relationship with Kundry and from conductor Mark Elder about the enormous influence Parsifal had on other composers and just how much Wagner's musical language had changed after he'd finished the Ring cycle. I'm also hoping, by the way, that Justin Way, the stage director for all but one of these Wagner operas at the Proms this season, will be joining me to talk about the challenges of putting them on here in the Royal Albert Hall. But that's after our first Proms Plus interval feature, recorded at the Royal College of Music earlier this evening, an introduction to Wagner's Parsifal presented by Martin Handley.
Today we're immersing ourselves in Wagner's final opera, a vast, sprawling epic, a work which has been variously praised and dismissed, or called the supreme song of love and pity. Certainly, it's the strangest and most inward of Wagner's works. So to help me unravel it, please welcome to the stage Stephen Fry and Stephen Johnson. Can I start by asking you the $64,000 question, and in just a couple of sentences, just as a starter, what's Parsifal about, and how big a part does that classic Wagner word redemption play?
Redemption certainly comes into it, and it's about 5 hours.
there you are, Mark. It's a challenge.
It's a Grail story. So anyone familiar with Chrétien de Troyes and the King Arthur and Knights of the Round Table will probably recognise that Parsifal is a Germanization of what was Parsifal, which is Percival, and the truest, holiest knight. And it's the story of, yes, a community of the Grail who come by their redemption through a man they call a holy fool or a pure fool, the Reiner Tor, which is this character, Parsifal. It sounds like most of Wagner's work, when you try and explain it as a plot, absurd, until you open your ears and you hear the sublime sounds and extraordinary characterizations.
So, Stephen Johnson, for people coming to this opera for the first time, maybe feeling a bit daunted by the whole 5 hours of it, how do you suggest they approach Parsifal to get a hook on it?
You've got to change your metabolic rate, musically speaking. Just as, for instance, with the Bruckner Symphony, you've got to accept that this is not going to go like Beethoven. With Wagner, particularly with this opera, you have to accept that this is not a work that's driven. It's not a work with a very clear sense of purpose. It isn't reaching out from the start for the ultimate orgasm in the way that Tristan is. It's a much more meditative pace, because Wagner was fascinated by some of the discoveries that German philosophers and German thinkers were making in Eastern scriptures in the 19th century, and particularly his great philosophical hero, Schopenhauer. His life was changed. He not only immersed himself in the scriptures, he even practiced yoga. And Wagner was fascinated by this whole idea of renunciation, of transcendence, of compassion being the great liberating emotion, and of the idea of standing aside almost from the process of time, which, considering that Wagner was coming to the end of his life, is something that was maybe more than particularly relevant. This idea of wanting to stand aside from the great rush towards mortality, which is also a very strong presence in this opera.
Yes. I mean, his source for the text, I think his main source, was this huge poem by Wolfram von Eschenbach, a romance from the 13th century, which has something like 26,000 lines, which he had to reduce, and reduced kind of to these three sections, these three moments of compassion.
He not only reduced it, but I think he also said at some point he understood why Frederick the Great, when offered this poem, had said, "Take this stuff away from me." He, of course, he had to compress and he had to He had to find the major characters and the major themes. It's not epic in the sense of The Ring or being epic exactly. It's an inward epic adventure, if that makes any sense. Mm. And what Stephen said is so true. You have to settle yourself in for it. I don't know if any of you like cricket, but when you go to a T20 match, you expect instant explosions of runs or wickets. And a wicket maiden or something like that is very dull. But if you love Test cricket, the slow build-up, the sessions, the rhythms as they arise and arise and arise, and the brain as it begins to take in the shape and structure of the piece, the architecture of the piece, accepts the length and the lack of momentum, as you say. It's certainly nothing like Wotan's Rage in it or any of those sort of famous...
Well, didn't Shaw say that cricket was invented to teach the English a sense of eternity?
Yes.
that's a good way, I think, of approaching Parsifal too. Yes, it's the next stage on.
I think it was in 1856 that he read Schopenhauer's Die Welt als Will und Vorstellung, his great masterpiece, for the first time, and it completely changed everything. And that's when, in 57, the next year, he sketched out his original plans for a story like this, and then abandoned them and wrote Tristan and Meistersingers. He was already had written the first two operas of The Ring, so he was just, and it was much, much later. It wasn't performed until the year before his death, 1882. Yeah.
And of course, if you... when you walk up to the Albert Hall and get presented with your libretto and read it, you may feel the same as, I remember, Bernard Haitink at Covent Garden, the last time he conducted it there. I'm sure he'll conduct it again, but the last time he did. He said to me that actually, when you read the text of Parsifal all on its own, it's all pretty horrible. You just have to sort of kind of lose that in some way, although there are moments. Can you empathise with that, Stephen?
Well, I can very much. There have been times when I've listened to or watched or heard Parsifal where I've thought, this is bizarre and I'm not sure I like it. But then I have to remember that that puts me in rather interesting company, to wit, Joseph Goebbels, who said of Parsifal in one of his diaries, you know, if this is ever going to find a place on the modern stage, we're going to have to get rid of all this Christian mystical rot. So the idea that it's somehow or other automatically leads on to Nazism.
And that's
just
a really interesting side of it, of course.
Yes.
You know, you must never let the anti-Semitism be the elephant in the room that isn't pointed at. And some people, particularly a man called Gutmann, wrote a savage, vile attack on Wagner, reading racism, particularly anti-Semitism, into every single beat of the music. And no one can deny that he was culturally anti-Semitic. Nor would I take away the responsibility of Wagner, if you like, and the continuum of his family and Stuart Chamberlain, who married into his family, for encouraging Hitler. But what's so interesting about Parsifal is the word Christ is never mentioned. Yeah. There's the Redeemer, Entlöser, I think is the word, isn't it? It comes down to something really extremely beautiful, which is part of Schopenhauer's philosophy. When people think of Schopenhauer, they think he's a philosopher who pointed out to us that life is useless, it's a waste, it's misery, and it's suffering. But the real conclusion of Schopenhauer is not the comfort of a religion that he couldn't believe in, but that human compassion can cure the suffering that the world is always in thrall to. And that, in a nutshell, is the story of Parsifal. That Parsifal, as a reinateur, as a holy fool, or at least a pure fool, a man of no knowledge, no particular physical courage. His first entrance is foolish. He kills a swan with a bow and arrow, and which is a deeply upsetting thing, especially to Wagnerians. You think what Ludwig would have thought of that, worshipping Lohengrin and swans. But there's this magnificent moment to look out for, which is when Amfortas, the king with the wound that won't heal, because it's been touched by the spear, one would assume of Longinus, if you were thinking of Christ, the spear that went into Christ's side. And his punishment is that it will never, ever heal, and it is in total pain, always. And there's one moment when he's being carried for the Grail ritual, which keeps the whole community alive, and he lets out a terrible cry of pain. And Parsifal instinctively just puts his hand to his heart.
Mm.
He has this empathy, this sympathy. And the real beauty of the work is in that simple truth that, you know, love one another or die, you know, compassion.
I can't remember. I remember the first time that I followed this through with the score and the words and everything. I remember being absolutely almost knocked out of my chair by the moment where it's Kundry's kiss. Yes. Kundry will say more of later, yeah, that yes. awakens Parsifal from his innocence. He's a sort of Father Dougal figure almost yes. before this. It's not innocence in a plausible, attractive sense at all. It's something rather blank and stupid and infuriating. It's Kundry's kiss that awakens him, as it were, to maturity, but in that moment, he also discovers empathy. And the first thing he cries out is, Amfortas. Suddenly he understands why this man is in pain. And I can't actually explain why that seems so profound and so extraordinary. And the movement, the music that's associated with it, you think, well, yes, Wagner, you may have had some fairly atrocious beliefs, but to be able to offer a vision like that is something so precious that one has to treasure it for its own sake.
Exactly. We can come to a great villain, the second act, Klingsor's Magic Kingdom. Klingsor... the backstory is that the Grail Brotherhood were joined, and in order to be... members of the Brotherhood of the Grail, and interestingly, Kundry at the end becomes a member, which is almost unthinkable. It becomes, it's like imagining White's Club or something, allowing women in. In order to be a member, you have to subdue, you have to be celibate, you have to subdue your desire, which is a very Schopenhauerian thing as well. Your yearning must be, you know. And Klingsor, so passionate a man, so desperate to become a member of the Brotherhood, his answer to subduing his passion is to castrate himself, for which he is banned and cursed for them, because that's not the point. That's cheating. You don't, you know... But it's very strong and extraordinary thing to put into a 19th century opera.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's go back, or continue with the music, but go back to the beginning. I mean, this is Wagner's final opera. We want to just ask perhaps where his music's ended up, so to speak. Let's hear the very beginning of the piece. Stephen Johnson, we hear about late Wagner and chromaticism. Well, that isn't chromatic at all, but there is a different sort of time feel to it, a timelessness feel to it.
Yes, I mean, a lot of people will have heard the kind of Lady Bird history of music version of what happened with Wagner, which is that Wagner teetered on the edge of atonality with Tristan, which, and the baton was then taken up by Schoenberg, who led music on to where it naturally had to go afterwards, discuss. Wagner was a great innovator in so many ways, and Parsifal in that music shows how he innovates in a completely different one. I mean, Wagner wrote some of the purest tonal, simplest tonal music in the 19th century. The prelude to Das Rheingold is nearly 5 minutes of one chord, a chord of E-flat major, and there, it's nearly 3 or 4 minutes into Parsifal before we got away from A-flat major. This is quite extraordinary. The second thing is, and for those of you here in the hall, if you're going to the performance, you might like to watch Mark Elder conducting in the beginning, and you'll see that his beat has absolutely nothing to do with what seem like the rhythms of what the strings are playing, because Wagner's written it out so that you get the effect of a kind of rubato, of somebody improvising timelessly.
It's all about pulse.
Yes, and then you get those pulsation effects, that beautiful sort of string washing sound of the pulsating strings, and they are moving in one time, while the strings and the trumpet seem to be floating completely freely of this in another. That is absolutely innovatory. Yeah. It's something that Sibelius picked up on.
Yes, Sibelius was one of those many present at the first performance in 1882.
Knocked out by it. Absolutely knocked out.
He wrote that of his own. He said, "This is why I want to be a composer, but why I know I will never be so great. Everything I have ever written sounds." Is like a cold jelly next to this or something, is the phrase he used.
Yeah, I remember, yes.
And Mahler, of course, was there. And
Messiaen, of course, is hugely influenced by this incredibly slow-moving drama, which at its heart has a ritual, and the essence of ritual is that it doesn't change. Yeah. It's timeless, it moves around in circles. And you even have the sound of the bells, which is a completely circular sound of just four notes that keep revolving round and round and round timelessly. Stravinsky picked up on that.
He certainly did. Symphony of Psalms. There's a lot of musical circular motion going on, I think, in this piece.
It's part of how it defies time.
Let's if we can hear this second example. So the way that Wagner uses these leitmotifs, these themes in Parsifal, is not cut and dried, is it? It's not not representative of a spear, a sword, or anything like that. These are very vague.
Well, if you've tried to read more than one book on Wagner, you'll probably find that the motifs have different names according to who you're reading. And I think there's no opera of Wagner's in which the meaning of the motifs is more fluid than in this opera. You know, it changes definitely depending on context. And sometimes they're more like symbols in a dream that leave you wondering what they mean. It's almost the ambiguity is the real key. And by the end of Parsifal, as these motifs swim around in this beautiful polyphonic texture, it's much more like the coming together of themes at the end of a symphony than at the end of an opera.
Yes.
So I think it's part of the beauty of the use of leitmotifs in this opera is that they are so ambiguous. That they're not like Debussy. Debussy said that when he went to the Ring, he felt like every time he heard a motif, he felt like raising his hat and saying, "Hello, spear motif. Hello, fate motif." It's much subtler than that in Parsifal. Yeah. He's gone a tremendous way from that, I think, as he does in Parts of the Ring, of course.
Indeed. Yes. And it being his dying piece, as it were, he died in Venice the next year after its performance. It was given that it should never be performed outside Bayreuth, that maybe it would be Bayreuth's cash cow, so the copyright was not allowed elsewhere.
They did,
Metropolitan Opera discovered that the writ didn't apply to them, so they performed it. But it wasn't until, I think, 1914 that they eventually let, and this is just an example of how extraordinary the appetite for Wagner was back then, as it still is today. One of the countries, I think it was Spain, it was about sort of 10:30 or something, happened to be midnight on 1914, because they were a little bit earlier than Germany, and they started. And between January the 1st and June the 1st, there were 50 different performances of Parsifal around the world. The appetite for this work was absolutely enormous.
Can I take you back, Stephen, you mentioned that the hero, the anti-hero, whatever, of Parsifal is der reine Tor, the pure fool. He's also the outsider. And isn't always, pretty much always, the hero of a Wagner piece the outsider? Is this Wagner himself, his feeling of being an outsider?
I think there's a great deal of truth in that. Wagner sometimes had moments of extraordinary honesty in his writing where he saw himself in parts you would never imagine. It's common amongst some to believe that Mima in The Ring is considered an anti-Semitic stereotype. And Cosima noted that Wagner had said to her, that's Cosima, his wife, yes. My lord, I just realized I am Mima.
Yeah.
So I think he saw parts of himself in all the characters. But yes, I mean, he liked the idea, I think, of what art could do. And the real point is that art could replace religion, and that the symbolism of art, writers like Fraser in The Golden Bowl were beginning to discover this, that the symbolism and the rituals of religion were attempting to give humans some kind of relief from their suffering, some kind of belief in themselves, some kind of sense of their place and use in the universe. And Wagner didn't believe any single religion could do this, but he did believe that art could. And that's why he had such an incredible thirst for philosophy and for theology and for Eastern theology and other things, because he wanted to combine them all to find ways of showing that these rituals, so the rituals in the Grail, he's not really the cup into which Christ's blood ran, the spear isn't really the spear. They're all, as you could call them, symbols of certain aspects of humanity, if you liked.
Stephen Johnson, you were saying earlier how important ritual is in this piece, in the music of this piece, and you wanted us to hear the end of the first act for this.
Oh, yes, because I think this sets up three important motifs that, if you don't know the opera, might be helpful for you. The first of all is one sung to a set of words, durch Mitleid wissend der reine Tor, through compassion made wise the pure fool. This is sung by an alto solo high up in the gods at the end of Act One. Then we hear on the chorus a beautiful figure called the Dresden Amen, which is not actually by Wagner. It's an old Amen, a Lutheran Amen, that Wagner had heard during his days when he was Kapellmeister at the court of Dresden, and he uses, or transfigures in this piece. And then finally we hear the sound of those bells and that rotating circular sound. We've just watched a kind of highly Wagnerized magical version of the Mass, haven't we? And now, as the act comes to the end, this circular movement on the bells brings us to that sense of timelessness, the timelessness of the rite and the timelessness of the drama again.
Let's hear that.
That's worth the entrance money alone, isn't it? Yeah.
Just one thing that's worth, tiny little musical detail, I just noticed, that sounds like an organ there, doesn't it, at the end? It's not. It's a fantastically scored wind chord. Wagner has such mastery of the orchestra at this stage. He can achieve just about any effect he wants with the members of the Standard Symphony Orchestra. That extraordinary sound. I was just looking at that chord before we came on and going, wow, that's scoring.
Well, that's the end of Act One. Act Two is much more sensual, you might say, Tristan-esque, the exotic world, as you were saying, Stephen Fry, of the outcast knight Klings or the flower maidens. It's more sensual, it's more dramatic. There's much more of a sense of action in Act Two.
There is, yeah. Before that marvellous moment we've just heard, poor old Percy has been kicked out of the out of Monsalvat, the name of the Grail monastery, for being an idiot, because he didn't seem to understand any of the gesture and the rituals. And so he finds himself in the Klingsor's magic garden, and Kundry has transformed herself into this utterly beautiful maiden, and Klingsor addresses her by various names, Herodias, various names back from history. She's ancient, she's timeless herself. So she's no longer the wild woman Kundry, she's now this extremely beautiful woman. And Klingsor is determined that this Parsifal figure, who frightens him somehow, must be corrupted, must be seduced. And the beautiful flower maidens sing to him, and then there's this, as you say, this magnificent moment when Kundry herself turns it on, and he's going to kiss her, and he holds back and thinks of Amfortas.
This is an extraordinary moment, though, because it's the first time in the opera, after at least 2 hours of music, that we actually hear the name Parsifal.
Yes.
And it's when she calls it out, Parsifal, and he stands stock still and comes up with this extraordinary line, "I think my mother once called me that in a dream." Yeah. And this is such an important turning point, isn't it?
It is.
It really is.
Here it is. I think one thing we are proving is that the music does it. We don't actually need any of the rest. But
no, it is one of the... Well, I think it's probably the opera that most... has least taken away from it, from no sets, just orchestral.
Stephen Johnson, can I just turn to you and talk a bit about Kundry herself? I mean, she and Parsifal are the two characters who make very different journeys. As Stephen Fry was saying, we've seen her in Act One as wild, half mad. Now she's the beautiful temptress, and in Act Three she'll become a kind of Mary Magdalene like penitent. She seems immortal. She seems anguished to be immortal in these three incarnations. Wagner invented her character. She's a sort of compilation from the sources. Is she the glue sticking the plot together?
Well, there's a fascinating thing about Wagner's heroes and heroines is that they're transgender. In a lot of Wagner's earlier operas, there's an innocent redeemer figure, and she's almost always a woman. But then in the last opera, it becomes male, it becomes Parsifal. Wagner was also fascinated, considering that he was an anti-Semite, this is rather striking, by the figure of the wandering Jew, an archetypal figure from legend, the Jew who cursed or laughed at Christ on the cross and was sentenced to wander eternally. The Flying Dutchman is a version of the wandering Jew. And this figure turns up, and he's usually male in Wagner's operas, but in the last opera, he becomes female, he becomes Kundry. At the same time, she's clearly standing in for mother in this act. Like most of Wagner's male heroes, Parsifal is an orphan. He doesn't even really know much about his parents. And so Kundry comes on. She gives him his name, the classic mother thing. "So my mother once called me in a dream." She awakens his curiosity about his mother. She tells him that his mother loved him and that she cared for him. And then she kisses him, and it's this one, we're on the cusp of Freud here, that the mother's eroticism is what awakens the eroticism in the child, but he then has to reject the mother, which is what happens in the course of it. He turns, it seems rather cruelly in context. And yet if you're thinking about this as a kind of maturation process that's going on, which will end with Parsifal being initiated into a male society at the end of the opera, that also makes sense. I mean, the thing is, there are so many different strands in this opera that you could possibly pick out. Yes.
The kiss is the light bulb moment.
The kiss is the climax of the opera. Yeah. It's the central climax of the opera. It's the moment that just suddenly, that's it. And Schopenhauer was fascinated by the fact that long before Freud, the eroticism and sublimated eroticism was at the heart of so many of our urges and instincts. And that really spoke to Wagner. Yeah. And so the idea of the kiss, this is what awakens him. But, you know, I remember thinking after I heard it for the first time, if Parsifal had just rejected her at that moment, it would be a piece of ghastly, unforgivable Puritanism. But because it's through this moment of his awakening, he understands why Amfortas fell. He was tempted by desire. He feels the pain because desire is pain. Yes. It's a tremendously complicated moment. And yet at the same time, it the music just makes it happen. You're not, you can sit afterwards doing what I'm doing and thinking about the ramifications of it. And yet in the moment, it's just... It's a light bulb moment, as you say.
So Parsifal catches the spear. Mm-hmm. The spear.
Yes, Klingsor throws the spear, yeah. Which he now has. The Brotherhood of the Grail should look after both the Grail and the spear as the holy relics. But they lost the spear because of Amfortas's desire, and he was wounded by it, and Klingsor kept it. And Klingsor throws it, and in various productions, I've actually seen it work, he throws it at Parsifal, and it stops midair in front of him. Parsifal takes it. It's an extraordinary moment.
And the kingdom disappears.
And the kingdom crumbles into nothingness.
And Parsifal wanders for years and eventually finds himself back.
Yes, that's the strange thing, is the time gap. Yeah,
this is where, as well, the Buddhist idea of non-violence, ahimsa, becomes very important. Parsifal uses violence when he's still innocent. To fight his way into Klingsor's castle. After he's become wise, he doesn't use violence anymore. It's a non-violent act that results in the destruction of Klingsor's castle.
You could call Siegfried a kind of precursor, couldn't
it? It is, you could. But also, when Parsifal arrives eventually after his wanderings in Act 3, it turns out that he is wounded because he's been unable to use the spear in his self-defense, because that's not what it's for. And this is where you get to the things where you can see Goebbels scratching his head and saying, well, that's not what we want
at all.
You know,
hardly.
All this compassion and non-violence. Yeah. This is why Wagner is so incredibly complicated, really.
It's true.
And the music in Act 3, is it a joining up of the music from Act 1 and Act 2? I mean, we've got this incredibly beautiful Good Friday music.
Well, it is the most symphonic opera of all in proportions. You could actually see it as a big three-movement symphony with two very big, spacious, slow movements framing a much more active central movement. And the key scheme bears this out. And the recapitulation, gradually, of ideas in Act 3 is phased almost like the return of ideas at the end of a cyclical symphony. Yeah. And indeed, as you get to the end of the opera, and everything just dissolves in this beautiful, ecstatic counterpoint. It's got the serenest, quietest end, I think, of any Wagner
Absolutely.
Opera.
Absolutely. And you should remember that, I mean, the Montsalvat was in a bad enough state with Amfortas wounded when we first meet it, but by the time we come back to it at Act 3, it's dying.
It's disintegrated.
All older. Titurel, the father of Amfortas, has died.
Yes.
And it is an absolute... It's the arrival suddenly back with Parsifal with the spear is the new king knight, and it's the full replenishment of the order. But before, as they all kneel solemnly and they're going to open the grail and it's all going to be marvellous, he says, for me, a very touching moment, he says, mein erstes Amst, my first duty, my first task, he baptises Kundry. It's a very, very touching moment. And then, in one of those inexplicable Wagnerian moments, as with Hundig, she then just dies, but the baptism is setting her free and slightly less mad than the moment in Die Valkyrie where it's gay, and then Hundig falls down dead.
Before we talk about whether this piece is Christian, Buddhist, what it is, let's just hear the end of the opera.
Thank you.
Wow. Yes. It's very difficult to say anything after that, actually. I mean, I was just going to read this little quote from Wieland Wagner, the director, grandson of Wagner, who said that for most people, Parsifal remains a Christian mystery play. And I was going to ask you whether that was true. And having heard that music, I feel I don't want to ask that question at all, really. But, you know, we've talked about it. It's full of Christian ritual, or ritual of a kind, and it's full of sexual guilt. What, apart from the music per se, does this piece offer us now?
I think, like all great art, it addresses the issues of guilt, passion, desire, suffering, pain, death, worry, companionship, all the things that we don't really understand, things we know that are somehow the curse and the blessing of being alive. And through his syncretic use of different religions and different philosophies, he has created his own legendary world that, yes, uses certainly Arthurian legend as its absolute basis, but draws in many other things too, to teach us essentially that simple thing. It ends with that moment we heard. It sounds preposterous. It ends with a dove on above the head of Parsifal. If it's done well, it just absolutely has you in tears. And it is, for all the monstrosity of the man, his music and his art was on the side of the angels. And I think this piece, perhaps more than any of his other works, proves that.
I recently reread another work that's had an enormous effect on me, Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. And I was fascinated by this because Dostoevsky wrote that book with a very clear intention in mind, and that was to vindicate Russian Orthodox Christianity and show that it could offer redemption to the modern world, as is contemporary with Parsifal, more or less. But as Dostoevsky himself admitted, although Alyosha Karamazov is the embodiment of his ideal, all the brothers are Dostoevsky, and that includes Ivan the despairing atheist. And Dostoevsky said that the conversations between Ivan and Alyosha, he wasn't sure whether in some cases Ivan didn't win. And it's very easy to believe that, particularly because of the way some Wagnerites talk, that Wagner himself is this great philosophical monolith with everything worked out and integrated and consistent. But I think that, you know, actually Wagner the man is riven with contradictions. And there are moments when, yes, as you beautifully said, Mima or Alberich may have been set up as an anti-Semitic caricature, but Wagner himself said that he felt tremendous compassion for Alberich and that the outrage at the robbing of the gold from Alberich is a great turning point in Das Rheingold. So there are these moments when something much higher than Wagner's ideology speaks through Wagner's art, and that is Wagner the artist rather than Wagner the thinker. And Wagner the artist is, I do believe, incomparably greater than Wagner the thinker, however impressive Wagner the thinker is.
That, I'm afraid, is all we've time for. For now, please thank my guests this afternoon, Stephen Fry and Stephen Johnson.
That was absolutely fascinating, wasn't it? Martin Handley, joined at the Royal College of Music there by Stephen Fry and Stephen Johnson for that Proms Plus event recorded earlier this evening, which was produced by Janet Tupper. Now, there's a Proms Plus event before every concert this season, so if you are heading for a prom here, do check online or in the Proms Guide to find out where and when it's happening. And if you'd like to find out more still about Wagner's Parsifal, it's amongst the BBC Radio 3 Opera Guides that you can find online from the Radio 3 homepage. If you look under Opera on 3, there's all kinds of insights there from experts, musicologists, singers and conductors. And don't forget that this performance of Parsifal will be available online via the BBC iPlayer Radio. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, Home of the Proms. I'm Andrew McGregor, live here at the Royal Albert Hall. And if you've managed to get tickets or to promenade for any of the Wagner operas here this season, you'll know that the singers aren't just standing and delivering. There's acting going on as well. And that means that somewhere in the background, there has to be a stage director. There is, and I'm delighted he's able to join me here in the box right now, Justin Way. Now, you've directed all but one of these Proms Wagner operas with no stage to speak of, no sets, no costumes, no stage hands to assist you. This must be utterly different.
But say no rehearsals as well. Yeah, of course it is. It's what an opportunity to have to encounter these conductors and these singers who are doing it. So, you know, I mean, it's very much a logistical responsibility. It's just a question of setting up the singers that they can, in concert form, sort of encounter each other and present as much of the story as possible, as much that they feel comfortable with, encourage their physical expressivity as much as their, you know, musical textual, put it all together to sort of, you know, to take the stops off where you can and just encourage them to go out there and really sell it.
So plenty of sensitive choreography, if you like, but no sort of rushing and leaping about, no props, no swords being
waved
in the
air. Oh, I would love to say lots of sensitive choreography. Well, of course not. I mean, there's really next to no time to actually... I mean, at no point do I have a session with the singers to take them through what we're going to do. It really is a question of as much communication as one can have with them in the orchestral rehearsals, in written form, sitting in the cafe, visiting their dressing rooms, sort of setting up as much as possible what, you know, the capabilities are in the space here. We've got some different entrances we can use. We've got five different entrances, so we can say that the Castle of the Grail's over there and the lake and the holy bath is down there and, you know, Araby is up that flight of stairs and set them off to tell the story based on some sense of...